Hello and welcome to this week's The Mad Tech Podcast. Today I am joined by our CEO, Ciarán O'Kane. Hello, Ciarán.
Hello.
And our guest today is Brandon Keenan from CNN. Welcome, Brandon.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Very welcome. Delighted to have you here. So we're going to kick off the podcast talking about sort of the three big news stories of the week. And the first one is that Google CEO Sundar Pichai testified before the House Judiciary Committee in Washington. The hearing was titled The Transparency and Accountability, Examining Google and its Data Collection, Use and Filtering Practices. And so basically he was questioned, interrogated by a bunch of representatives. One of the big topics was whether Google is bias against conservative views, with the classic question, why is it when I Google the word idiot, a picture of Donald Trump comes up? So that was a great start to the questioning. He was also interrogated about kind of the bias over Google products. So if you Google certain things, then obviously their listings come up, their maps come up, their business reviews come up, and their kind of, you know, a travel info. And obviously that kind of came after that they were recently fined by the EU $2.7 billion antitrust fine for prioritising their shopping listings over and above other products out there. He was also grilled on whether Google will be launching a censored search engine in China. And he basically said, not necessarily at this time. So obviously there's been a lot of furore around that recently. And then the big topic, of course, was data privacy and Google's approach to data privacy. And Google has claimed, and Sundar has claimed, they will make it easier for its users to be able to control their privacy settings. And I guess the question from the representatives was, how far will that go? What does that mean, making it easier? So everything was quite vague. And it kind of begs the question, did the representatives really know what they were talking about? Were the right questions being asked? Did anyone feel that kind of Sundar Pichai actually gave information that made people feel like, okay, yes, we can understand what Google's motives are. We can see where this is going. What are your thoughts on kind of how Google, I guess, reacted to that?
Brian.
I mean, look, Ciarán might argue, I'm in the camp that Google is not inherently evil. So I think they, you know, there's a
yeah,
lot Ciarán of things.
Ciarán might argue that, yeah.
There's a lot of things they do. But I really think, I mean, look, there was a couple moments there where one of the senators or congressmen said, if you don't want to be listed as bad news, you know, about you, then don't do bad things. And if you want to be good, do good things.
Yeah, and inherently so, on you.
Yeah. And they kept asking, can you manipulate the search results? And their answer kept being like, no, we can't. You know, and I think it's a pretty big task. I mean, what they've done has changed the world. I mean, it's pretty incredible, right? And so, I'm also not totally, I mean, look, if they benefit, are they able to put their stuff first? I mean, Google's their product and they want to sell things and they put things there. Now, I do get there's arguments on both sides, but they are a business and they're a pretty good business, right?
Do you think they're inherently too powerful?
I don't think Google's evil. And I agree with Brandon. I think they've created products that are real benefit to society. Search is a benefit to society. They create utility products like maps and email that actually have real value, right? I think Google are one of those companies that you can have a love-hate relationship with. On forcing and advertising, they have a monopoly, right? They have a monopoly of search. And to a certain extent, they have a monopoly of display and video, okay? In Europe, anyway. They own most of the ad tech that publishers serve their ads. I'm pretty sure CNN is a customer of Google's, like most publishers. We use DFP ourselves, so we are as well. But at what stage do you think they've got too much power over the digital ecosystem? And I think they've gone past that mark way, way long ago. And particularly on the GDPR side, I know, look, I'm not expecting American senators to have deep intrinsic knowledge of our industry, because it is quite complicated. Ad tech is complicated. And a handful of people would know what it is in the Senate. It's very hard to legislate for Google for antitrust because digital is so fluid. Like, I mean, where does it start? Where does it begin? But in our space, in advertising technology, they have unbelievable power. So what hasn't been reported about much is the fact that Google has literally put everything on one platform. You know, DFP is now Google Ad Manager, and they've just basically centralized the whole process. So that gives them a one-stop shop. It's a first-party war, right, which Google wins. And to the point about privacy, I can only see one way of managing your privacy, and that's the browser settings. It can't be true. Like, how do you expect a user to kind of go the whole way down and opt in and opt out? The browser is the only place logically to do it. And who owns the biggest share of the browser market? Google. So then you start thinking about, okay, they have all of these bits and pieces of huge parts of the ecosystem. I think the right thing for Google is to divest themselves of certain products. I don't think breaking Google up and destroying a company is in anybody's interest, because it's a remarkable story and a startup and it's a huge business. But I think they now have too much power over two. I would like them to sell Chrome. I would like them to seem forced to sell Chrome and divest themselves of YouTube. I want to see YouTube as a separate company. And that kind of restricts them a little. They can still make money because search is hugely important.
Yeah, but don't people like that seamless experience of having your Chrome browser and your Android and your, you know, all things connected?
And that's the other thing.
There's an Android element that I actually enjoy that.
Well, yeah, from a consumer perspective, it's
not a case of that, right? I agree with that. The seamless user experience is fantastic, right? But from an economic benefit, it's not helping the ecosystem to have one company to have such power. Like, you've just mentioned Android. They own Android, which is the operating system for 70% of the mobile market in Europe. They own 60% of the browser market. They literally have 100% of the ad server market. And they have the biggest ad network. And they own search. They have the biggest amount of video. They have the biggest DSP. I mean, at what stage do you say enough's enough? This is not me being anti-Google, but at some stage, you have to think about the rest of the ecosystem, right? Publishers like CNN want to work with multiple vendors, and there has to be sort of plurality in the space.
I mean, Amazon's 53% of retail. I know it's a little off topic, but 53% of sales are retail sales from Amazon.
Yeah.
So you get companies, because they do things right, and they do what the consumers want, they grow. Like Google Search, I mean, Bing took a shot at them, Yahoo took a shot at them, Ask Jeeves.
Yeah, Bing's a good business now.
All these people took shots at them, and Google continued to outperform them, and people preferred them. So, you know, I do agree on the ad tech piece, and that's the part that gets, you know, when they own the entire stack from top to bottom across
Google should never be allowed to buy DoubleClick. That should be blocked off the bat. And that shows the lack of knowledge and capability that legislators have. They don't understand what that deal was.
At a time they really wouldn't have understood it back then. They would never have had any clue the implications.
I think if Google were to buy DoubleClick today, there would be serious questions asked, and it wouldn't probably go through.
It's too late. Like,
I agree. Like,
how many competitors do they have? You could count the number of competitors Google has in the ad server market, right? So AppNexus have an ad server, but I don't know what their plans for Xandr is. It could be just a network with an SSP layer. I don't know. We'll know more this year. And Smart, obviously, are a competitor. But really, like, where is the scaled competitors to Google? Like, Google has the run of the shop at DFP, which then gives them an in with AdX, which is about 30 or 40% of most companies' revenue. At some stage, you start going, looking at this and going, oh my God, look at the power this company has. Like, I think that Google should be restricted to how much of the market they own, right? Now, they own nearly 95% of the search market, which is a massive market and growing at a clip, right?
Well, it's funny you say that, because actually Sundar brought up in the hearing that they were talking about Google's dominance over search. He said, well, actually, Amazon's the biggest search engine. People search Amazon before they come and search for us, which is getting to be true. But of course, we're talking about one section. Like, Brandon, you're talking about kind of Amazon's dominance in retail. Their dominance in ad tech, is still only at 4%, but that will keep growing.
Yeah,
and could search be the in to...
But then you have to ask yourself the question, where is Amazon's money coming from, right? They're not stealing money from our ecosystem, not stealing stuff. They're getting money from in-store merchandising, like in-store marketing. That's where Amazon's getting the budget. I just want to see more sensible legislation. I want people to just look at this problem and not ask silly questions like, what are you doing for privacy? If that was about user privacy, fine. But if it was about Google's power and how much... economic power they have, then we need a separate hearing. We need to have sensible people going, here's my business, this is how much I make. And then I don't know what to do. I mean,
one of the senators said, if I take my phone over to this side of the room, would Google follow me? And he said, yes, if you opted into that. And he said, I just want a simple yes or no.
Yeah.
Could you follow me? And he said, if you opt in, then we could potentially see that. And then the other questions were around like Wikipedia changing information and Apple. And he's like, those are not our products, but they are so interwoven and they're all collecting this kind of data. So there has to be transparency and ease, because it is confusing. If you've ever gone into your phone especially on an iPhone, and tried to stop location tracking. It's like 7 or 8 steps. It's a pretty deep thing. You have to follow an internet instruction and say, okay, go here, and then they'll stop tracking you. The common person is not going to do that know to do that.
And it was discovered that actually even when you did turn those off, there were still certain apps that were still tracking you, and they got in trouble for that recently as well.
Yeah.
I think if you look at Google's, if you're talking about kind of a separate hearing around Google's dominance,
I think there's two questions here.
I think that would be one that would be led by Europe, because Europe are already trying to, Vestager, for example.
I think Vestager has a handle on them and is zoning in certain parts of the business, but I still think she's not doing enough. I think she needs to get in the weeds a couple of ad tech people in a room and say, look, tell me what Google's doing. Tell me how powerful they are. And she'd get an honest, frank conversation with a publisher, an agency. They'd be able to tell her straight out how much power they have. And then she'll realize, God, this is a problem. Like, I don't believe in breaking up companies. I don't want to restrict Google from growing because it's a fantastic company and may they continue to build brilliant products.
But buy them mostly, actually, but yeah.
Yeah,
but that's the problem too, is they acquire and crush. So they make it, and a lot of companies, even Facebook, they all these guys with that much money, they just acquire companies and sunset them. So that way, so it doesn't create a fair, it's not a fair marketplace. It's not fair at all. So that's something that those acquisitions come in, they should look at, I think.
They're just taking people down. People and companies taking them down.
Well, the other problem we have here in the market is they suck up so many good people into their company. Like, so then you're left with a dearth of talent to build these companies that compete with Google. It's like debt by 1,000 cuts. And, I'm not accusing Google of doing anything untoward, but when you're in a dominant position, they can do whatever they want. You know, the other day I saw, I was searching for domains, right? Buying some web domains. And they come up the top thing ahead of all the things. I'm going, how are they allowed to do that? This is a business for, like, so now Google basically, who owns that domain? And they actually have their own. I know it's open API, right? Google do that. But they're taking money out of someone's pocket using their influence. I think that's wrong. Google should make enough money off advertising without start introducing, travel search. That was wrong. They should never be allowed to do that.
We're starting to crush like TripAdvisor and Yelp and all that, because now as soon as you leave a restaurant, Google says, how was your experience? Yeah. And you see now the number of reviews growing from Google versus where you might have logged into Yelp or TripAdvisor or somewhere else and left a review. So they're slowly crushing that business.
And look, Maps is amazing, right? You can star certain restaurants, favorite restaurants in cities that you can go back and find. Like, that's an unbelievable utility. But at some stage, you think, we've got to kind of, like, you got to muzzle a wild animal, and that's what they are like, you know. You got to muzzle them, you got to keep them under guard, let them struggle, but you kind of, you feel you have to put them.
But as a consumer, would you use a subpar product because you didn't want Google to have dominance? Like Apple Maps came out and I got lost a number of times. I tried to use Apple Maps because I didn't want to use Google, and I realized horrendous. Google's a superior product.
Yeah. Right, okay.
I tried and failed.
Don't use a subpar product because at the end of the day, it's kind of like, you know, climate change, people start thinking, that's a whole nother topic, but
let's not go there. People
start thinking about what's in it for me in the short run, and they stop focusing on the bigger picture because they're like, well, it gets me to where I need to go.
But then you could argue, counter argument, habit is a strong motivation. If you get into a habit of using a product and Google has the first ins in that and then learns from that, and it's a kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy, like, you know, it's a competitive edge. And all you want to do is get the politicians to say, ask serious questions and do what they need to do. But at this stage, how do you stop Google? Like, I think the only way you can do it is make them divest of certain products.
I'm going to move on from that because that's far too long talking about Google.
I still love Google, by the way.
We all still love company. Google. Great company.
Love
you. Yes.
Love them.
Love you, Google. Right. Next is Oath. So Verizon have announced they're going to take a $4.6 billion charge for Oath assets. It's quite a significant write-down. Considering they bought Yahoo for $4.48 billion in 2017 and they bought AOL for $4.4 billion in 2015, effectively Oath is now going to be a $600 million company, which, you know, is worthless, basically, in comparison to what they were quoted at. But and Verizon have admitted that actually combining the AOL and the Yahoo assets together and making them become Oath taking much longer than they expected, and hasn't necessarily provided the benefits they thought they would see in doing that. So I guess the question is kind of what is next for Oath? Like, did Verizon do the right thing buying those platforms and merging them into Oath? It's taken a long time, as they admitted. We've all seen that kind of working with Oath and the sub brands as companies. what do they do next? Is it, should they look at the publishing business? Do they look at the tech business? Do they split them, divest some of it?
Look, there's a lot there. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot of things that are well above our knowledge of finance and how companies manage all that stuff. But there is, I think there's one interesting point that hasn't really been mentioned. I saw a small snippet about it, but it is still, and to kind of spin it back to the power of a brand, right? And the power of a brand is sometimes everything, right? And when you look at some of the companies out there that are these big, strong brands. And I remember I used to work at AOL, and I actually worked at Platform A, if anyone remembers that,
yeah,
that thing, right? And so Platform A became a thing, and a very short-lived thing, because the first thing Tim Armstrong said when he joined the company was, why are we Platform A? The entire world knows AOL, right? And so he immediately just canned all that branding, and it became AOL again. And it was easier. It was easier for us to get meetings. It was easier for us to talk to clients because they're like, oh, AOL, I know you. Yahoo is also a massively strong brand. And then you took two brands that are world-renowned and called it Oath and started killing off those brands. The value of those brands changed. So I don't know if that has anything to do with the valuation,
really
how they do
point.
The accounting, but that brand changed. And is Oath a brand that resonates in market to consumers?
Like, still not. And obviously the big, we've mentioned this a few times, but kind of most markets can't even say the word Oath. They literally can't say TH. So
right.
To them, it's nothing. And for that reason alone, it's not going to resonate versus
you don't
the
have
power
Oath
of Yahoo
mail.
And AOL.
I still have an AOL account, sadly, but my mom uses AOL email. Like, and in America, especially, AOL is a fabric of the internet. We know that brand.
Yeah, America Online.
And then to crush it is like, well, what is this Oath? And then all of a sudden, everyone's brand loyalty and affinity, it'd be easier for you now to leave that brand when you don't have that. So I wonder if there's an element of that to play from a consumer standpoint. Mm.
It's interesting. It is an interesting point. What do you think about, because, you know, we were chatting earlier before the podcast started about the cost required for news gathering and why the likes of Google have done it so well, because they've just become an aggregator. They've become a source of aggregated news. And you've got, obviously, the brands like HuffPost, TechCrunch that exist under the Oath brand. Is that becoming too expensive for them to do business? Should they be focusing on the tech side of things? Should they be focusing more on the publisher side of things?
If you look at Oath from a like proper overview, it's a bit of a messy coming together, right? And as Brandon said, there's some really valuable brands in there. Like, you know, Yahoo Finance is a really interesting product, and I know they're trying to make it into a subscription. I don't think that's the right way to do it, considering that most of the content is aggregated and automated. Like, they basically rewrite using using tech, AI stuff. I don't know. What did he want to do with the brand? Is it core to Verizon's USP, right? So 5G is all of the CEO from Verizon, when I saw him on CNBC, talked about it. He never talked about Oath at all, right? So maybe there's not enough love in the company that. And inherited lots of different technologies within Oath. And I mean, they're doing a job to knit all that together into one platform. But integrations of different technologies is tough and takes time. And if your parent group isn't really interested in the business, how are you going to grow that business, right? When you look at AT&T, right? They are all in. They just dropped $1.6 billion on AppNexus to power a lot of that. I don't know what happens. It's a funny one. You know, you'd like to see them succeed because it's another player in the market that makes everybody else honest. But is Verizon really, you know, dedicated to it? Did it really want this?
You know, I think a big piece too in this is a company, anything needs an identity. They need to know what they're fighting for, right? And if you're just fighting to bring together some stories and sell ads, that's not that exciting of an identity, right? Like, and I think for me personally, the one thing I found, you know, at CNN is really exciting. Like, we don't sell ads, we don't sell sponsorships. We provide revenue to help tell stories that change the world, and we know that day in and day out, and the clients that work with us know that. So it is one of those kind of it's a mission. And I think when Tim joined AOL, he really got everyone bought into this mission of bringing this brand back to life and really taking over the internet. And then all of a sudden you get acquired, and it's like, well, there's obviously other big missions and submissions, and not everyone's bought in. So I think it gets a little tricky. You got to know what you absolutely believe in, and you got to know exactly where you're headed in order to really be a successful business.
Do you think that Tim leaving was a big, left a big hole there in terms of vision.
He was the heart and soul, the cheerleader. He was the guy that brought that back.
And he's amazing. Like, you watch him and you just think, oh, wow, this is amazing stuff, Tim. You're like, I'm bought into this crack, you know?
It's like Tony Robbins. You walk out and you're like, He got it the second he started there, and he knew what he wanted to do. And not saying all of his decisions were right or wrong, but he made decisions and he stuck with them and he drove that ship. And as soon as you lose that kind of North Star kind of direction and that mission, I think people then sit and start kind of going, well, you know, where are we going? And it's hard to be part of a company that doesn't have an identity.
But the problem I have as well with a lot of the reporting around this is very negative. I'm just like going, you know, there's some really, really interesting assets in Oath, in that business. You know, Yahoo Finance is an amazing publication and huge traffic and sports as well. I could see LinkedIn buying Yahoo Finance. That would be an obvious one for me. And then you could see Axel Springer buying HuffPo, TechCrunch go to a B2B company. You know, there's a lot of assets in there that people would want. I think the idea that, blah, 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 it just didn't work out. But the problem is the vision, is the leadership as well. If the parent company is a telco, right, and its main mission is to sell subscriptions, 5G subscriptions, that's his business. Like, there's difference with AT&T. AT&T obviously have a huge TV business, so they're already in that business, right? So they need to figure out the next 10 years of that business, right? And the Brian Lesser hire and all the rest of them, and the AppNexus piece, as long with Time Warner, is part of that vision. So I agree with you, the vision. They've got a vision. I think it'll work as well. You know, using the telco data to power that. And it would be interesting to see what happens. Oh, I've heard a few stories that some PE firms are sniffing around that, but it would be interesting to see. I'd like to see it go to a company who believes in the products.
Mm-hmm. I've been a listener as well, and I know your strategy of make lots of predictions and hopefully something hits.
So,
you just threw about five acquisition things. Yeah. There. One of those hits, you're going to make sure that you let the world know you predicted it, right?
Yeah, that's probably right. I think that's
exactly right.
What is your hit rate?
That's pretty poor. I got the app Nexus one right, but I thought as soon as Brian Lesser went, that was obvious to me that was going to happen.
You didn't even give it that strong a...
No, I...
You weren't that convinced.
No, I wasn't convinced. I thought it was a bit... But then, you know, these big... There's rumours going around that Vodafone is looking at Adform at the minute, which is quite interesting, because of the GDPR stuff, and they want to activate and manage their own data. An ad form has a DMP and a DSP layer and an ad server. So that'd be quite interesting. I think there'd be more deals like this, switching subjects quickly, but I think there'd be more of the AT&T app next. I think big media companies are going to, big telcos are going to start buying advertising technology.
On the subject of brand mission, understanding where your business is going, we're going to move on to the final news story, which is WPP. So WPP is rebranding amidst announcements that is going to have a creative focus. It is turning into a creative transformation company. So Mark Read is obviously making his presence felt. There's been a lot of folding of companies. There's been a lot of merging of companies. And there's a clear shift from the media part of the business to the creative part of the business. And they've obviously rebranded. It's pretty funky branding. I quite like it. Others may not. But what do we think is going on with this? Like, he had an investor day recently where he said he wants to ban the word digital from WPP. Not because he thinks it's, you know, you could argue what that means, but his point, which I think is a fair point, is that the distinction between what people are defining as digital versus analog is just too confusing, and it's getting people lost in the vision and the mission. So do you think Mark Read's on the right track?
You want to take that, Brian? One of my very few predictions has sort of come right in a sense, because, you know, when I know that search agencies started going into search, big holding companies started moving into the search market and started bringing search experts in-house and started managing people's search. And you knew that was a little bit of a race to the bottom because the margins used to be really high, and then it became a commoditized business.
We used to get kickbacks from Google. That was the good old days for search. So,
So, and
10%,
and
that, wasn't it? Or was it more?
But it depended.
Yeah, so the, you know, moving that in, really that kind of started this trend of shifting holding companies and agencies, which were known for creative and known for their people and their execution, into this kind of tech world. And then programmatic became a thing. But now you're seeing that trend of programmatic going in-house, right? I saw a crazy stat. I don't want to quote the stat, but there's a, you probably know, the big percentage of companies that are now pulling their programmatic in-house and taking it from agencies. And agencies count on that and being a big revenue model. Where I've always said is agencies have incredible people. That's their talent has always been what their asset is. And creative, data meeting creative is, I mean, with all this AI and computerized, creative will still, even if you use AI to build creatives, everyone's going to end up with the same creatives, right? You still need that human element to make incredible stuff. And there's still a market for that. Is it as big as WPP has gotten to that point? I don't know, but I do think you'll see a shift of agencies going, wait a minute, our money's still in creative and data and creative, not in some of these automated pieces.
But is that a growth business? I mean, you look at WPP.
It's a bit of a cash cow, really.
I look at WPP.
It's a margin business, but is it a growth business? I don't know. I mean, I'm not.
The growth for all holdcos over the past decade has been from the media side of things. Right. The creative has always been almost like the stalwart.
Okay, so media is obviously what grew that business, right? They've got 146,000 people in the company, and they've laid off 3,500.
Yeah,
right?
They're cutting.
So.
It's not much when you're at that scale.
No, it's absolutely massive. So,
and probably easy to do as well. 3,500, obviously it's terrible people losing jobs, but 3,500 people in that size business, it's probably not a difficult thing to be able to say we can cut the wheat from the chaff here.
But they also said they're going to add 1,000 more on top of that. So it's going to be a net of 2,500, is that right?
Yeah. And they've done this before. They've cut heads before, so they're probably just kind of cutting again what they replaced since the last time they cut, which was about 8 years ago. So it'll just be a process. But he wants to make savings of £275 million by 2021, which will be a mixture of folding companies, merging companies, and obviously headcount cuts. And he believes that within WPP, who obviously has been on a mad, mad, mad buying spree over the past God knows how long, he thinks there's far too much duplication, which you can't disagree with.
Yeah. I don't know the inner workings of agencies. I find the whole and grip model confusing. I try to look through their P&Ls and I can't figure out where the money is coming from, right? So I guess the opaqueness is probably helpful in that sense because you don't have to answer any questions because nobody knows what's going on. But at some stage, you see what's going on around the fringes though, right? The programmatic thing, right? Every part of media is becoming data-driven, right? Okay, there'll always be terrestrial TV and radio, but more and more stuff is becoming data-driven. The ability to buy in real time, whether it's CNN or a WordPress site or a radio slot or whatever, it's all becoming easier to do, right? So that black box of media buying is becoming is opened up. So clients now are going, well, you know, I'm going to manage a lot of that. And particularly with the data privacy issues, they're becoming more and more possessive of first party data because it's their USP, right? Your customer data is your actual USP as well as your product, but that data is invaluable. So these headwinds are all occurring now for agencies. Plus, you've got all the consultancies, buying agencies, buying creative agencies, buying ad tech, and getting into this game as well, figuring out that there's a big play here. So, you know, holding groups are under a lot of pressure. Like, where did they go? Is it to double down on creative, or is it to identify the gaps that are going to occur for big brands around MarTech and ad tech? Because there's a thousand different vendors navigating that world, figuring out how your data works. I mean, you see these consultancies popping up now, specialists in, you know, data management, data execution, right? Because those skill sets are
but not creative.
Not creative.
You're not going to see Deloitte building a creative team that's going to compete with anything else. So I think it's going to be, and it's not just the building creative, because I know there's creative agencies and planning buying agencies, but it is that funnel or that chain of data informing decisions, driving creative, leveraging the data to understand what happened and building this kind of a very scientific plan around the data. I think the plan and buyers will be around that piece and the create. There's got to be that merge. And you won't see the Deloitte or these consulting companies building that.
I don't think...
It's not their skill set.
But that feels to me like a very different company than WPP is right now, right? It feels you need to consolidate that, and if it's creative you're going for, then focus on that and bring in all the media planning by and put it all together, right?
What is the number? Is it 40% of brands have brought programmatic in-house? There's a number.
There is, but they still need execution. Like, you know, you still need people to do.
They just hire out of the agencies. Right?
That's the thing. It's then. I mean, it's the question of how you define in-house, because in-housing can mean different things to different people.
Look, you see two different models existing or appearing here, right? One is the WPP model, which is Double Down in Creative, and I don't understand. I don't get this. Like, I'm a creative person. I can draw a stick, man. That's about it, really. This is as far as my creativity goes. And then you've got Martin Sorrell, who's obviously feels hurt and hurt about the exit from WPP, and is fueling his business empire in a minute. And he's gone the other way, where he's bought Media Monks, which basically is using automation, building creative TV assets for various brands, and then buying Mighty Hive, which is execution layout, which does a lot of in-housing. So you see very two different models. I don't know if WP's got, if there's enough market for them to grow their current business to be bigger. Like, if you're an investor, what do you expect from WPP? What's your ambition? To grow their business 10, 15, 20% every year or incrementally? I'm confused about what the holding group, the future of the holding group is. And I'm sure Mark Read's doing a great job. And he inherited a bit of a mess because the current state of things, the programmatic, the consultancies, the in-housing, this is all happening at the same time. But where do these holding groups go? What are they? You know?
I mean, Sorrell found it. He found growth and revenue from an acquisition.
Yeah, and that's how
Reed's,
he feels.
If Reed's come out now and said we're not gonna do any more acquisitions, then he has to find that growth organically in other ways, and that's going to be tricky. And they do need to find. And this all kind of does lead back to that kind of transparency and knowledge and understanding of where everyone sits and what they bring. And it is about bringing value. Like, what is that value that an agency brings to clients, and how are they growing brands? And I think they focus on that. If they focus on that value point, then I think they'll be fine. If they focus on some of these other techs or margins and just revenue, it's going to be tricky.
You mean rebates?
I don't know anything. I mean,
yeah, that, yeah.
I mean, I think that, I don't think, I don't think comment. They still do those or not. But I mean, that's.
Oh my god! Now listen, man. Are you serious?
I mean, look, I've been in the business a long time, and I think there's an element, but a lot of it is transparent, right? Like,
right.
A lot of them will say, well, if there's any sort of revenues coming into the agencies, then the clients know about it, right? And I think that's the key, is making sure. And I think clients are really starting to question these things and like saying, well, wait a minute, if we're all, it really is, has to become a we're all in this together. And to your point you made earlier, it's also with publishers, right? There's a whole ecosystem here. And if everyone's in it together and working together, right? The things about news gathering is not cheap. The things about writing incredible stories is not cheap. Building great creatives is not cheap. Like, doing all of these things, if you really want high quality things to happen, then all the partners need to be involved and transparently rewarded in the right way. And if anyone starts pulling out, some of that profit, off the side, it just breaks the whole system, because you have to, if you want to do unique things, you want to do great executions, you've got to be able to invest the money in the right places and actually pay these great talented people to do it.
I think, in fairness to Mark, he's probably obviously an avid listener to this podcast.
I'm sure.
But
completely respect what he's trying to do. It's an impossible task in many ways. He's been asked to do an awful lot in a very short space of time. He has the markets breathing down his neck. He has these headwinds that we discussed beforehand. It's a really tough task. And that's not just applying to WP. It's across the board. Publishers are going through a similar sort of consolidation and refocusing. And some of the US holding groups, IPG bought Acxiom, which I thought was pretty smart, because now they've got a data asset. So they're all kind of trying to figure it out. It's a new world. Like, we've been seeing this coming for a while, haven't we? Like, we've got programmatic is a mechanism for buying media, right? But what it's done is it's sped up the process of our move away from the traditional way of media buying, right? And now the TV is now becoming connected, and radio and all the rest of it. It's kind of crisis time for a lot of the holding groups going, what do we do next? Like, how do we stay relevant in this world? How do we keep making money?
And I guess fundamentally, I mean, obviously all these big changes are happening kind of at the top level. They don't really ultimately affect the day-to-day workings and operations of those businesses, and the fact that the teams still have to deliver for their clients. You know, Publicis Media, for example, was the coming together of Starcom Media versus Zenith and everything else. I mean, actually, they still operate under their different sub-brands. The day-to-day jobs haven't changed. It'll be the same thing with WPP for a while as well. Kind of making all these kind of top-level changes doesn't stop the fact that I've still got to do my day job.
Yeah.
And that's where, are these actually making fundamental business changes, or are they just headline grabbing?
To be fair to the agencies, they are doing some really tough changes. They're making tough changes and they're doing it quickly. And these things, I guess, take time, especially for legacy businesses like these holding groups, because they're massive. 146,000 staff. Hard to get that moved around fairly quickly. So we'll see. I mean, look, you got to give them time and see what happens. But there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of problems on the horizon. And the in-housing thing is getting momentum, you know.
You see, I mean, you do see a lot of agencies. I work in with some incredible agencies that have incredible relationships with their clients and very deeply integrated. To where you start thinking, there's no way this relationship of this agency and this client are going to be separated because they're so intertwined and they work together. They're colleagues as opposed to like an agency. And
the classic pitch team of an extension of your marketing team.
Yeah, you see it work, and some of those relationships and some of those that history, you know, is really important. You know, and it really is understanding a client's business, and the lines do become blurred, and that's why in-housing becomes a thing. But there is an element if relationships and value, you know, driving value stays intact, the agencies will be fine. They just have to make sure they have to focus on the right things and be efficient. I think they'll, you know, I'm still very pro agency at this point.
They fulfill a massive function within the ecosystem. Like, you know, helping brands build brand equity is no easy task. It takes a phenomenal amount of talent and effort to do that, and they're still necessary. It's basically the bit in between, the delivery that has completely changed the way that we buy and sell media, which is probably their biggest problem.
I do like him taking out digital out of the word.
Yeah,
that
was overdue at this stage.
But anything, I mean, like, you know, I talk a lot about this too. Is like most of the stuff that we do is cross platform, is all screens, and you know, it's audience, but it's also experience. And you have to think, if you start thinking about silos, it's kind of like, I guess, when agencies first, you know, came into the digital world, they had a mobile team and a video team and a social team.
But it's a way to make money.
They still do have that, though.
Well, some of them do. But I mean, how do you do, tell me how you do mobile without social or video?
Well, because
they
should.
But so video for me is just, it's a platform. If video is video, you know.
Yeah, but still on the media.
What's a TV? What is a TV? I guess, you know, I guess when people talk about TV, they talk about, is it linear? Is it digital? Yeah. Or is it connected? And so when we think about it, it really is, you know, should there be people who understand both sides? Of course, but really thinking about when you sit down with a client, it's like, oh, well, here's the digital team. We want to talk to you about this strategy. It's like, no, we should really be holistically talking about it. I think that's what they're probably getting at, saying, we don't want to be talking about clients about a digital strategy. We want to be talking about clients about everything, an overarching strategy. And then, yeah, there'll be teams that come in and do their specialties. But we really want to talk about cross-platform, whether it's TV, whether it's linear, it's connected TV, it's digital.
That's a sensible approach. A holistic view of the market, right? We've got advocates saying you spend all your money on Facebook, and then got another bunch saying you spend on TV. It's meat in the middle, right? You still need to hit the people on Facebook, but you still always need TV for upper funnel sort of brand building, right? And people still watch TV, right? Whether it's connected or linear, it's still happening, right? And maybe this is a good pitch from Mark to go, we're a bit holistic, right? Because the world is digitized, right? The whole lot, right? It is, in one shape or form. But we live in a cross-platform world, and you've got to build, particularly big brands, have got to build models that fit that, like, you know. I find it hilarious. We were digital specialists. What does that mean? I mean, everything is practically digital.
Does that mean nobody else knows digital? Because I know people on our team that are not digital specialists that know more about digital than there's some very skilled digital people. So is a generalist a bad thing, or is a generalist a good thing? Because that means you're a specialist in everything.
But so what does it mean? I could run a campaign on Facebook in 10 minutes. Does that make me a digital specialist? I can run an AdWords campaign. Does that make me? I can put analytics and understand analytics. Does that make it digital? I think this is going to happen. We're going to have to start thinking about it. Those skill sets are going to have to be core to what you do, right? If you just say, I'll just buy TV media, it doesn't change. It will change. It is changing. Digitization is coming to TV. It's happening right now, right? The on-demand stuff, the connected TV stuff. We're in that war now. You need to know this stuff, otherwise you're redundant, right? So I think, get rid of this digital specialist. It's a media specialist. I know about everything, because you have to. It's your job.
How is this changing for you? You're a TV video based business, obviously CNN. When you're speaking to advertisers, are you having these cross platform conversations with them now?
I mean, it's crazy. When I was in, CNN has a big office in London, and I think, you know, being in media in London for you know, almost 10 years now, I never knew they were there. You know, like I always consider them kind of this US-based company, and maybe they had it, but the operations that they have in Europe are pretty incredible. And it really is a complex solution. I mean, there's lots of things going on with TV, with linear, you know, with linear, with OTT, with voice, with digital, with programmatic. I mean, there is a lot of things, and it is we do have to simplify and create incredible campaigns, but we have to make sure that clients understand a lot of the whys and you know, why you do this, why you do that, and so because there is a lot of moving parts, and so you need to be very good at that. And I find it fascinating. I've never worked at a company like this that had all these different elements, because there's a lot of companies that now have 100% reliance on, say, social or Facebook, or 100% reliance on one thing, and I don't think that's going to do very well. I mean, you have to have multiple products. You have to have, you know, be where audiences are and be where advertisers want to be. And you got to do all of those things really well. So for us, it's incredibly exciting. I think 70% of our deals are cross-platform.
Interesting. Meaning, and you're seeing publishers do a lot of diversification. So while they would still consider themselves to be a news-led publisher, they're also doing things like travel, like jobs, all those kind of things to bring in new revenue streams, I guess, to help fund the news gathering we've been talking about. Are you sympathetic with the plight of publishers and kind of having to diversify to maintain their status?
I mean, look, I think at the end of the day, news, it's all about storytelling, right? So if you tell travel stories, I mean, people love travel stories, they love food stories, they love, you know, they love all these things. So it is about getting content and increasing time spent, and publishers do have to think about, you know, there's a balance between making sure your consumers get what they want, and then also making sure you have something that you can monetize for advertisers in a way with some of the metrics that are being thrown around now. So there is an element of making sure you do that. And yeah, I mean, I've always been very sympathetic to the publishers, because I think in the value chain, it is such an important piece, right? Publishers have always been a piece, in some respect, you know, over the years, I think it's getting a lot better. I think this shift with GDPR and this shift with all these things, you're starting to see premium environments and brand matter. And at CNN, we're a brand and a publisher, so there's an alignment to that. But premium environments and transparency and for advertisers, knowing where you are is really important. So that shift coming back, but I think over the years, publishers have been a bit kicked. It's like, yeah, well, you're just a publisher, right? Nobody was really sympathetic to the fact that how expensive it is to do this stuff and to do it really well. You can't just do it, you know, half-assed. You have to tell great stories in an incredible way that engages a consumer. And if we forget about that, then you don't have, you, the whole ecosystem breaks down.
Do you think that the GDPR stuff is speeding up this closer relationship with users, right? So consumers. And as you touched on it, do you think that's going to benefit particularly European publishers now are thinking about this? Like, so for instance, there's a lot of talk about universal login, right? And that could be the first steps to building something that can compete with Facebook and Google. But do you think the GDPR thing has sped up this need to have more deeper ties with the users?
Yeah, I mean, well, universal login is funny. Isn't there like 15 companies vying to be the universal login? So, you know, in a capitalist mindset, is anyone going to say, yeah, we'll just let you do it? So I find that to be a little bit tricky. You know, with us, I mean, consumer relationship, consumer data has always been a huge concern. You just can't have data, and you can't have personal data, and you can't throw it around willy-nilly. You got to be very careful with it. And you have to trust and respect your consumers, because consumers know, you know, at some point, they don't always know exactly what you're doing with it, but they know when they can trust you or not trust you. And I think it does change the ecosystem, because they're you're starting to see, you know, consumers and readers start gravitating towards publications they trust, because there is an element of, I know what you're doing with my data, or at least I trust your brand and I trust what's going to happen with that data. And I do think that there, I mean, you're starting to see the big word now is D2C, right?
Well, we're all in. A new publication called DTCDaily.com.
Did I just give you a nice segue to a plug?
You did. Thank you
very much.
But D2C is the buzzword, right? So, yeah. So, and I think another buzzword, you know, for prediction standpoint is e-com, which is also D2C, which is also affiliate. And you'll start seeing shoppers get closer through publishers, through, you know, to that direct to consumer kind of buy. So it's subscription, but it's also product.
So like
you're seeing this real shift to that
bottom of the funnel, sort of like ready to, so they go to like a review site, like, is it about.com or, what do you call them now? Dot something. They're like,
dot dash.
They have a ton of like, tech review sites, and they're pushing about $300 million in spend to Amazon, which is obviously they're taking 10-15% of it, which is significant revenue. So you think that those publishers having that bottom of the funnel, and remember, like, you're right, like, I'm about to buy a car, or I'm about to buy whatever, I want to go somewhere where I a trusted site. Maybe I don't trust Amazon, I want to go to someone with a bit more reputational you know, to get a better insight into that product.
Yeah, I mean, look, for luxury too. I mean, you go buy luxury products. You're not just going to go to a luxury. You're gonna do some research. You're gonna go to publications. You're gonna read stories. You're gonna learn. You know, there's influencers. There's stories. There's travel stories. All sorts of things. And then you slowly start formulating your opinion. And then it's about building that relationship to where are you gonna buy that? And I think where you're gonna buy that is going to change dramatically over the next 12 months, 18 months.
What do you mean by being able to buy it online? So luxury, obviously, we've covered this in our other podcast, Around Retail Tech News, and luxury brands are starting to build their own sites, their own e-commerce sites, selling directly.
They're no longer using the platforms like Net-a-Porter and Yuke's, which is interesting.
Well, you're starting to see luxury brands that are starting to come out with these kind of boutique and sometimes internet, you know, only like web only like launches, right? So they're kind of going, well, and that's very new to some of these 100-year-old, you know, watch brands to go, well, we're going to do this boutique like launch thing and then run this and selling a watch online only. Is pretty unique. And you do see, the stats do show that, I mean, everyone knows people research this stuff online, you know, significantly. So having that right story in that right place, right time, all those, you know, that I know it's a cliche, but it's still true. And making sure you're there. And then having that relationship where you're going to buy it, I think that path is going to change a bit.
That's interesting. So publishers may end up opening new revenue streams, particularly around the affiliate business, because a lot of them are at the bottom of the funnel, trusted. And so that you think that because the relationship is getting strong between the publisher brand and the user, there is going to be opportunities to make money outside of the, you know, targeting, micro-targeting world of programmatic and display advertising.
I think so. I think the power of brand is important. And I think that's where publishers will be able to leverage those brands. And some of these publishers, like us, have been around for 35 years. And I'm not just saying this because we're that publisher, but I'm saying like other publishers, when you're in an environment that you trust, then you may be more willing to do that than when you're in an environment you don't trust. Because you're going, well, wait, let me think about this for a second. So it is about trust and it's about that experience. And then you might be more willing to do that.
We are running out of time, but I want to say thank you very much.
That's Kieran's fault, not mine.
I did just say, to send a gesture saying he's been talking far too much.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm a talker too, you went for
well,
it.
Well, maybe we'll get you next year and I'll talk less.
Maybe. Yeah. We'll give Brandon more of the podium,
you did, absolutely.
But anyway, on that note, I want to say thank you very much to Kieran for talking too much, and a big thank you to Brandon for coming in today. It's been having you.
I've reached the pinnacle of media. I'm done.
Well, you have.
Yeah,
exactly.
You can retire, although you have to win the Ad Tech Personality Year to really retire.
I need a parody account, though, after me, but I'm not. No, I don't have that many followers.
Well, next year I'll put you on the list.
All right, fair enough.
Okay.
I got to get a personality, so I can work on that.
anyway, thank you. This has been the Mad Tech Podcast.